The Teaching Saints Virtual Summit was an incredible success. We had thousands of individuals tune in from around the world to hear from people like Brad Wilcox, Hank Smith, Casey Griffiths, Marie Eckersley, Jason Hewlett, Jeff Burke, and more as they taught us about how to better stimulate classroom discussion, create effective classroom environments, best practices with object lessons, and so much more. If you missed the summit, be sure to visit leadinglds.org/teach to watch the three most viewed sessions from the online conference. It will not only change you, but it will change those you teach. Check out the Teaching Saints Virtual Summit today. Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. Hey, welcome back to the Leading LDS podcast. My name is Kurt Frankham, and I will be your host. Now, back in 2007, I came across a fascinating book called The Mormon Way of Doing Business, which was written by a well-known author by the name of Jeff Benedict. It was a collection of interviews with influential LDS businessmen that illustrate how their religious views influenced how they went about managing their companies. If you haven't checked it out yet, I encourage you to do so. One of those businessmen interviewed in the book was David Neeleman, who is most well known for founding JetBlue Airlines and now manages an airline in Brazil called Azul Brazilian. I've always respected David Neeleman for his influence in the business world, but also his philanthropic work he has done, especially for the LDS Church's influence online through the More Good Foundation. A few months back, I was at an event, and from across the room, I saw David Neeleman. You can imagine how shocked I was that not only was he in Utah, but he was at an event I was at. I garnered every ounce of courage I could find and walked across the room, introduced myself, and by the end of the conversation, I was asking him if he would ever be open to an interview about leadership in the LDS Church. He didn't even hesitate as he gave me his personal email and told me to reach out. A few months later, the interview happened, and I am excited to share it with you now. We talk about the development of his testimony, how he approached unique leadership situations while running large corporations, establishing healthy culture, and even his experience with attention deficit disorder. This is a fun one, so listen in. Here is my interview with David Neeleman. Today, we are talking through the powers of the internet with David Neeleman. How are you, David?
I'm good. Awesome. Thanks for having me on, Kurt.
Nice. Now, where in the world do you find yourself today?
I happen to be in Los Angeles. My son plays lacrosse at the University of Utah and had his opening game last night up in San Luis Obispo. And so I'm just down here watching him play and then headed up to Utah this weekend to go spend a week skiing with my grandkids that are out of school.
Wow.
Especially my East Coast grandkids that are out of school next week. So we're going to ski all week in Utah. So I'm glad we got a little snow up there.
Sounds like a plan. And how's your sons? How'd they do? Did they win?
They won. Yeah,
oh,
they're good. They're good. They're going Division I next year. So it's kind of an exciting thing for Utah and the lacrosse. And, you know, they're the furthest team west that's Division I. So they beat Cal Poly, and so they're off to the races. Hopefully
they'll have
a great year. And then next year, it gets serious, really serious fast.
So I bet.
It's a fun sport.
Awesome. Now, for those that may not be familiar with your background and some of your successes in the business world, what sort of background would you tell us? What do people need to know about you?
Well, I kind of had an undistinguished high school career. Didn't do much at all and was fortunate. I went up to the University of Utah for a year and didn't do very well there either. And so I was fortunate to make a decision to serve a mission. And so I went off to Brazil and that kind of changed my life. You know, I had a long association with Brazil. My dad served a mission there and then he went back to work as a journalist and I was born there. So I had a Brazilian passport, but I didn't really speak Portuguese, but I was fortunate to be called back there and had a great experience. I, you know, kind of for the first time in my life, I felt like I could really accomplish things. And it was right after, it was in 1978. So it was right after the revelation giving all ordained males a priesthood. And so it was an explosion where we were up in the Northeast and, you know, like 1,000 baptisms a month. And it was just, it was a time that I'll never forget and I'll always cherish. And I think it probably set me up. I'm positive that it set me up for successes later in my life. just learning how to love people and how to lead and how to, you know, how to change people's lives for the better. It was, it was a great experience. Came home, went to the University of Utah. We got married and I, you know, started kids, and it was, I ended up dropping out of the University of Utah to start my first business. So, which I failed because one of my suppliers failed at the same time. And then got a call from June Morris, who was, had a very successful travel business at that time, mainly doing corporate travel. And so we started, you know, Morris Air together, and I ran that for almost 10 years and we sold it to Southwest Airlines. And as part of my deal with Southwest, I had to sign in a 5-year non-compete. And it was an interesting time because I, you know, I got an amount of money that you would think, you know, back in 94, it's all the money you ever need in your life. You can retire at that point in time. But I was only 33 years old. So I wasn't, you know, looking to retire, and made some kind of investments that I realized that if I was involved in it and passionate, it didn't do well. And so ended up starting an airline up in Canada called WestJet. It's still around today, very successful.
Yeah, I love their commercials.
And when my non-compete, and then when my non-compete ran out, I went east. We moved the family back east, and we started JetBlue. And so that was great. And you know, but life keeps making turns on you. You just never know, and you just have to do the best with what you've been dealt. And so I, you know, was very unfairly, I thought, treated by the board, and got moved to kind of chairman. And then at that point in time, I decided I would go back to Brazil and, you know, start a business there. So I went to Brazil and started Azul, and I took some guys with me. Fortunately, we had some guys at JetBlue that actually had served missions in Portugal. And, you know, one guy who was an LDS, he had a Brazilian girlfriend, so he knew a little Portuguese. So I took him and we went down and started a real successful business down there at Azul. And so that's been great. And then a couple of years ago, we privatized TAP in Portugal. So got the team over there running that. So it's been kind of a whirlwind, but it's been a lot of great learning experiences along the way, doing businesses and, you know, starting businesses in 4 different countries or running them in 4 different countries, you know, be it Brazil and Portugal and United States and Canada.
Yeah. Wow. And I speak Spanish, and I know that azul means blue. I assume it's the same in Portuguese as well. What is it about the color blue that keeps popping up in your branding?
Well, it's not because I'm a BOE fan, but although my nephew's going to be he's a quarterback down there this year, but I don't know. It's just the sky is blue and we fly. So it just seemed to work. JetBlue was great. And then I think Azul was a little bit of a takeoff on JetBlue, you know, just because I like the color, and I thought Azul was kind of a cool word. So, I always believed that the name didn't really make a company, you know, you made the name. So didn't really matter what you named it. Is, you know, it's how you treated people and how their experience was for traveling.
Awesome. Okay. Now pivoting back to your mission, obviously this was a pivotal point in your life, which it is for many young men and women who have the opportunity to serve. Would you say there's anything in particular about your mission experience that was different than others or that really fostered that development of your personal drive in your life?
You know, I think it just, obviously you need to have a lot of faith, you know, to be away. And so you kind of, you know, the old adage of you know, work like everything depends on you, but pray like everything depends on the Lord. And a combination of hard work with lots of faith, with an area of Brazil at the time that was just really ready to hear a new message, and people who were suffering and needed to hear, you know, the gospel message. And just that watching people's lives change and being able to, you know, lead missionaries and to be able to kind of, you know, at that time we weren't so, you know, caught up on curfews and all that. So I used to, my zone would, I'll meet back at the ice cream parlor at 11, you know, midnight, and have ice cream, and then walk to the street singing hymns all the way back, counting up how many people we had taught and are going to be baptized. It was just, you know, it was an incredible time, you know, it was a chance I had to lead, but also just, you know, be humble and be able to kind of impact people's lives. And saw that whole area of Brazil. I mean, there were five branches when we showed up, and within 6 months, we had 5 stakes from 5 branches. It was just incredible. Wow. So the growth was just phenomenal.
Yeah. So, and I assume, is it, you have 9 kids? Is that accurate?
Yeah. I adopted one, you know, my 10th recently. So yeah, I have 10.
Oh, so you bumped total up to 10. And I assume 10, some of them.
And then I have my 18th grandchild will be born in a couple of weeks. So,
oh, congratulations. That's fantastic. So lots of kids around.
Lots of grandkids. I've got my 9th daughter. She's just got called to Brazil on a mission. So I'll have, that's the 5th one that I'll have serve in Brazil. So
nice. I'm sure you, you're a little bit more excited when you hear him rattle off Brazil, right? So that's awesome. Yeah. That's cool. So what type of advice do you give your children as they're preparing to leave, as you reflect back on your mission, as far as, you know, some really solid development as an individual, as they go out and serve?
Just to love the people, you know, I mean, lose yourself, you know, don't think about home, just get down there and just love, you know. I think the gospel is love, and it's having that desire to change people's lives and to give them the message. And if you just focus on the people and, you know, the amazing change that you will bring to their lives, then you'll be successful and you'll be happy, you know, because, you know, I think people, sometimes you go on missions and you're homesick and you think about yourself, and you don't think about others and count down the days, and, you know, you just don't have a successful mission. And, you know, I said, you're going to be there anyways, you know, you might as well make the best of it.
Yeah.
You might as well just lose yourself. And I think all of my kids have kind of followed that advice. They've had great missions and had the opportunity to pick them up on all their missions and just watch their, you know, the members that, you know, the people they taught and people they converted. And, you know, it's just watching them go out and then come back, you know, different. It's a real joy. So, you know, the missionary program is obviously one of the great things of the church. Thank goodness we have it.
Yeah, that's amen to that. When you returned home from your mission, obviously you've had this, you know, a pivotal moment in your life. And then how did that manifest itself? Do you feel like that experience is what drove the inner entrepreneur in yourself and led you off on this journey of starting businesses?
I think so. I mean, I think obviously it let me know that I could be successful at something, you know, because I had never really had it, you know, been very distinguished in anything. And, you know, I think entrepreneurism is, I think that it's a combination of a lot of things. I think some people just, I mean, I've been pretty public about my ADD.
Yeah.
Attention deficit disorder. And where scholastically, I'm maybe not the brightest bulb on the porch, but it's just given me the ability to look at something, at things differently, you know, just kind of in a different way and a different, you know, things that were just not, you know, as obvious to other people. You know, when I was at Morris Air, my first airline, I invented e-ticket travel. We were the first airline in the world to ever go ticketless. Mm. It was so obvious to me. Why do you need an airline ticket? Why can't you give me a confirmation number? Like hotels and rental cars were doing at the time. So we had to create a reservation system that was able to track all that, you know, with a kind of a relational database. And then that turned into another company that I founded with my partner. But, you know, it was just looking at it and saying, why do we need this? And then, you know, I started JetBlue. It's, you know, and the other thing we pioneered at Morris Air was in-home reservations. And so all of our people, we couldn't hire quality people. So I said, let them go home and work. Mm. And so the technology existed. And so all of a sudden we had all these quality people wanting to work for us. And today, if you call someone at JetBlue, I actually called someone the other morning as I was going to having trouble getting my seat assignment. So I called, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning in Salt Lake City. Somebody was there in their bathrobe and furry slippers, you know, attended my call and took care of me, no problem. And as happy as can be. So, and then, you know, onboard TVs, live TV, you know, just looking at things differently and looking at a way to slice and dice. And, you know, there's lots of innovations we've done in Brazil too, that have made us extremely successful down there. So
yeah.
I think that was just, so I had certainly had the drive and I had the desire, but I think I also had this wiring that I just looked at the world a little bit differently, and I could figure out things that maybe, you know, that no one had ever done before. And so yeah, it obviously got comical after a while when people would say, well, if that was really possible, it would have been done by now. I go, I don't think so. So, you know, I think we're seeing today in technology and things that, you know, people are innovative in ways that we've never even imagined before. And so it's not, people don't say that as much today, but that was always kind of, you know, the resistance I got. Well, you know, people would have done this if it was possible. So,
yeah.
But you know, and I think it's just, and some people just don't have what it takes to be an entrepreneur. You know, they better that they work for a company, and people ask me all the time, you know, how do I want to become an entrepreneur? What do I do? And I say, well, are you willing to make the sacrifices? Are you willing to, you know, do everything necessary? Because some people want to do it, but they don't really have, you know, not everybody's cut out for it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. You know, and you mentioned you've experienced ADD throughout your life. I know there's many youth leaders that listen to this podcast, and, you know, they may have some youth that they're helping to develop and succeed in life. And maybe they look at, you know, ADD at times, man, this is frustrating. You know, they just, they're more difficult to work with, whatever, you know, whatever it is. What encouragement would you give to them or tips if, just from your experience with ADD?
You know, this is it's a passionate topic with me. And it was interesting because when I started JetBlue, you know, we were in New York, it was, you know, high profile. You know, we're in this media capital of the world, and I started talking about it. And my PR director came to me one day and said, you know, X-nay on the ADDA, you know, that's good enough. You've said enough. What's that? You know, and then I was like flying on one of our airplanes. I met one of our crew members, and, you know, and they were explaining to me that they, you know, their father had married another lady and they had two kids. And one of them was very studious and, you know, went to an Ivy League school and successful in every way. And the little brother was just kind of out there and, you know, gregarious. And, but he wasn't, you know, couldn't study the same way as his brother. And his mother was very disappointed in that and let him know constantly. And eventually he ended up taking his life because he didn't feel like he measured up. Mm. And so there was over 1,000 people that came to his funeral, and they said he was, and I really believe if that, you know, had he been encouraged the proper way and said, look, you know, your gifts are differently, he would have been more successful than his brother. Because, you know, it's kind of this humorous little saying I always say is that A students work for B students, C students run the companies, and the D students dedicate the buildings. So, you know, it's not always the case, but yeah. You can find lots of examples where people dropped out of college to go, you know, serve their, you know, to go after their dreams. And I don't let my kids drop out of college unless they had something really good and they've all graduated. But, you know, there is something to be said about somebody who's, you know, really passionate about things and, but maybe not as book smart, but actually can look at the world differently and being able to be successful. And, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there from Elon Musk, you know, to, you know, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs that I think everybody, you know, kind of believes, even they don't talk about it, have the ADD. So, you know, it's a great gift. It can be if it's handled properly.
Yeah. You know, that's definitely been my experience. Not that I have officially been diagnosed with ADD, but I relate more to a lot of those characteristics. And I remember in school, just, you know, struggling through, you know, I graduated from the University of Utah with C's. And when I graduated, I felt like I realized I was starting to succeed at these different things in the world that I thought, man, nobody ever told me I could be good at this stuff. But, you know, it's just, you get out of that world but it can be very discouraging while you're in that traditional.
It affects, your confidence a lot. And that's why you got to look at successes and you're like, okay, you know, this is different. So it works out great.
Yeah. Now, during your time, probably even now, but, you know, in the media while you were at JetBlue, I think people looked at you as very unconventional CEO and leader. You know, there's stories about you, you know, being in the trenches with your workers, handing out snacks with the flight attendants during flights and, you know, just trying to jump in and help out. Was this an intentional decision that you made early on? Did it come naturally to you? Or what's the genesis behind some of those characteristics?
I think part of that is what I learned, you know, being a member of the church. You know, where the church is very egalitarian that way. I mean, everyone's kind of equal in the sight of God. So I think, you know, that was my orientation and training. And, you know, I got to Brazil and, you know, it kind of drove me crazy that, you know, the poor people seemed to be held down and they weren't treated the same. And, you know, there was a really stark difference between those that had money and those that didn't. It's almost like those that had money wanted to keep the people, you know, the less fortunate down because, you know, they wanted to have their maids and servants and gardeners and all that kind of stuff, which really irritated me. And I felt like the economy wasn't really built for everybody down there. It was really built for those that could afford it. And that was one of the reasons I started the airline down there, to get people flying who can have never, you know, flown before. So I think I had that orientation and I always felt that everybody was equal. You know, I wouldn't allow executive parking lots where only executives could park and executive lunchrooms where only executives could eat. And those are just things that really bothered me. So, and I loved being with our people, you know, and they were really the people on the front lines. They were the ones that were actually, you know, made the company go. And I've always said that, you know, it's kind of at our company, you know, every company I've ever run, I've always said that you're either, you know, serving a customer or you're serving someone who is serving a customer. So, you know, we're a service company. And if you're not talking to a customer every day, then your job is to make sure that those that are taken care of in every single way and have the right tools, they have the right training, you know, the right uniforms, everything that they, you know, make sure that they have the ability to make decisions, you know, to take care of our customers. You know, that's really what it's all about. When I got to Brazil, it was funny because I kept you know, my Portuguese was a little rusty, you know, from the mission, and I really just knew kind of gospel nomenclature and conversational. Yeah. I didn't really know a lot of business stuff. I was trying to learn all these words. And so, you know, I said, okay, I want it. What's the word for servant leadership? And they're like, what? What is it? What do you mean servant leadership? You know, so the leaders aren't servants. Well, they are in my business. They go, no, that's not the way it works. You know, so I had to come, you know, we had to actually kind of, you know, I had to coax out the, what I could use for the word and explain it, because it just didn't exist. You know, it wasn't something that was even in the Brazilian culture, a servant leader. And so, you know, having to teach all these people that your job is to serve those people, you know, not to dictate to them and not to demean them, and, you know, it's to serve them. So
Wow. That
was something that we, you know, that was, it's an interesting insight going into Brazil and changing. And our company today is just fabulous down there. Our leaders are amazing. They serve our people. And then we have this mantra that, you know, I want this to be the best job you ever had. And because I know if it's the best job you ever had, our customers will be able to say it's the best life they ever had. So as I go down there and I meet with people, they just keep saying to me, this is the best job I ever had. This is the best job I ever had.
Well,
so
that's
gratifying, great. You know, when you have 12,000 people that work for you that can say that.
Yeah. Now, obviously, some of those traits really stimulate a positive culture. I mean, that's what you're describing, right? And so early on when you're doing those things, I mean, you had led many businesses leading up to JetBlue. And so did you think that every CEO sort of took that approach, or was it something you didn't even know you were doing before somebody pointed out to you?
No, I mean, I had some good training at Southwest Airlines. You know, I mean, I wasn't there long because they bought, you know, Morris Air, my first airline. Mm. I was only there 5 months before Herb Kelleher, who's a legendary guy, decided that this wasn't a place for me. But, you know, I love the way they took care of their people, and I love the way that, you know, was, you know, very gracious with his people. And he used to always say that he didn't really think about the shareholders. He just thought about the people, because he knew if the people that worked for the company were happy, they would take care of the customers, and then the shareholders would just be taken care of.
Yeah.
So that was his attitude. And so I think I learned a lot from her, you know, during that. To go along with kind of what the training I had in the church and my natural kind of instincts. So, you know, I think that those things were very beneficial for me as I learned how Southwest did things.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to a lot of these things stimulating culture, I mean, in any organization, having positive culture can solve a lot of problems. And so I'm just thinking about, you know, a newly called bishop, an elders quorum president. You know, a lot of these individuals don't have that business background, even realize that culture is a thing that's there regardless if you meant it to be or not. So what guidance would you give on somebody running a ward or a quorum? How can they start to begin to establish really healthy culture?
Well, you know, it's obviously there's, you know, the fine line between priesthood authority and, you know, being a servant leader too, you know, making sure your job is to, you know, strengthen the flock and make them happy and make them be fulfilled at church. So, you know, I think from a quorum level, if you have a, you know, an elders quorum president or a really steady president, you just have to make everybody feel like they're loved, you know, and feel like that they're needed and wanted. And a way to do that without making them feel guilty or feel like they're not, you know, measuring up, it's a real gift. And it takes, you know, obviously a lot of prayerful thought but just focusing in on the individuals, and not just because it's like your duty, your check of the box. But it's like, what can I do to show love to this person and let them know that we love them and we care about them? And, you know, it's not easy. But I think the more we can, you know, follow the Savior's example and show love and not just make it a program or, you know, something that you have to do, but kind of look at it from that perspective, I think that's what would make a really good leader.
Yeah. And on a day-to-day basis, what does that look like for you? Do you have certain routines in place that help remind you to focus on the individual? Because I'm sure after 4 or 5 meetings in a day, suddenly you're not even thinking individually. You're just trying to, you know, make sure that the company keeps moving. But is there anything you have in place to help you remember to focus on the individual?
I think if you ask some of the people that work directly for me, they may not tell you that I all the time am the
yeah,
you know, maybe as Christ-like as I maybe should be in my fans.
You're but, human, okay.
That's you know, I think. But what I care about really is the company's success. It doesn't do good to give a job to 12,000 people if it's a weak company and it's not something they can be proud of. I can remember, and we had this great guy who was our attorney, Tom Kelly. He's a great man. He's been a mission president. He's been stick president. And so we were getting together on the values for JetBlue. We were in a room and we said, okay, what values do we want to have? And so we spent a whole day, it was members and mainly non-members in there. And we came up with these five values, and it was safety, caring, fun, integrity, and passion. And then Tom Kelly, who's this Gandhi-like guy, you know, said, well, he's this amazing guy. He said, well, these principles are kind of Gandhi-like, but can we make money doing this? And it was funny coming from him, of all people. But, you know, I think, you know, safety, caring, fun, integrity, and passion, and if you can create all those, then sometimes you have to be tough on your people. And sometimes, you know, make sure that they're accountable and make sure that they're taking care of the people on the front lines. And, you know, one of the saddest things in business sometimes is when you have to make a change on someone's just not doing what they need to be doing. And, you know, can't always have to, I think about that, the scripture back in First Nephi, you know, it's better than one man perish than a whole nation to know disbelief. And those are some of the hard decisions that are made in business. And sometimes I'm probably not the, you know, the nicest guy sometimes, but it's all done because, and I think my people know that it's all because I want exceptional companies and I want people to be proud of where they work. And I want the company to be successful. And I want it to be, have a job, not just for, you know, our crew members today, but for their children and for their grandchildren. It's going to last for a long time. So I'm very demanding, but, you know, on the other hand, I think people like working for a company that is successful and is doing great. And so I think, you know, sometimes the sausage is tough, but the product is, you know, the sausage is made, but the outcome is really what you're after. And, sometimes you got to break some china to make it happen. But so I'm not perfect in any way in that area, but, you know, I do feel like I've changed people's lives by creating great companies to work for.
And I love that mention of, you know, standards and values and obviously holding people accountable to that. As you've had, you know, whatever leadership responsibilities, maybe in the church, whatever assignments or callings, have you seen any of these values or habits transfer over there? I imagine you have, since that's your mode of operation.
Well, I was like a ward mission leader for like 8 years since I became in ward, and we had a lot of baptisms, you know, the ward that had never, New Canaan, Connecticut, had never had it before. So, you know, it was just a lot of loving and a lot of finding people and changing their lives. That was the best calling I've ever had, really. So I'm just, you know, just trying to inspire people, but also let them know that, you know, we know that there are challenges in this life and you just have to look at the bigger picture.
Yeah. So with JetBlue, obviously you found it important to establish some clear values, you know, make a list of them and whatnot. If, you know, for a new elders quorum president or somebody running a quorum, would you suggest they go through similar activities with their quorum or presidency where they're really establishing a vision and values to follow in the quorum?
I think so. I mean, I think it's, you know, important to, you know, the old, what would Jesus do? Or, you know, if you're here right now and, you know, just figure out, okay, these are the people that we're serving and we're just basically instruments in the Lord's hand. What would he have us do to help these people, you know, be successful in their spiritual growth, in their material growth and all the things that they need? How can we show them the best amount of love that we can, you know, and balance that? You know, obviously you can't just do that all the time. You got your own personal lives and you've got your own personal things that are happening. You know, where I live, it's, you know, every guy or woman, you know, those at work have very demanding jobs. You know, I always say that Monday morning, they climb in the belly of the beast and then it throws them up on a Friday night and they're like, where am I? Training in the city at, you know, 6 a.m., getting home at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night, and don't have a lot of time for anything. And then all of a sudden the weekend comes and now they've got responsibilities. They have to take care of their own family, but others as well. So, you know, there's balance, but you can do it with love. It goes a long way.
Yeah. And so at JetBlue, when you had these values and that you established, and let's say, for example, a quorum decides to put some values in place or a vision, what do you do with them at that point? What do they look like in the day to day? Are you always pointing back to them? Are you trying to, do they impact each policy?
Yeah, you have to refer to it always. You can't just make something, write it down, and then forget about it, not act on it. You know, our values were around everybody's neck on their IDs, so everybody could see it every day. It was, you know, it was plastered on the walls of the workplace. It was, you know, in every single communication, it was at the bottom. I mean, every single person in the company could say the values. And so they had to, so you couldn't just tuck them in a drawer and just go through the exercise for the sake of doing it. You had to actually incorporate it in everything that you did. And so that it stayed right on top of mind. Otherwise, it just isn't effective. And it's just a waste of time.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I want to talk about, you know, obviously you were featured in the book, The Mormon Way of Doing Business. It came out, I think, more than 12 years ago. I read it when it first came out, enjoyed it. But it talks about, you know, this dynamic you face as being a busy executive running a business with work-life balance and some of the methods and ways that you do that. And one thing I laughed when it says is that you do not golf, right?
I don't really have any... I don't have any friends either. Yeah, I don't really have time for friends or nice. For golfing. I don't know. I don't have a Saturday where, you know, I can just go and spend 8 hours golfing. I mean, you know, I always made it home on weekends. I was always 5 soccer games or a couple football games and basketball games. I always made time from, you know, my kids. If it was important, I was always there. And, you know, I just have priorities, you know, and my best time of life, you know, then and now is when I'm with my family. So, you know, be it here in California, watch my son play lacrosse, or, you know, next week up skiing with the grandkids, you know, having 10 little grandkids on the slopes, and being, you know, at nights and having, you know, making oven baked pizza together and cooking together and laughing together. There's just nothing better than that. There's nothing else I'd rather do in my life. So, yeah. Just golfing just doesn't seem like it stacks up to that. it doesn't stack up. So,
well, you're probably right.
And because I didn't golf, my kids don't golf that much. So, you know, unless they're all there together, if they were all out there together and, you know, that'd be fine. But then yeah. I'd want to be with my grandkids. So it's just, you know, it's just all about priorities.
So as you look at your life now, you know, as you've had decades of experience working and running businesses, I would imagine you would, if you could go back in time, you would counsel your early self as far as work-life balance goes. Anything come to mind as far as what you've learned that maybe you didn't understand early on in your career?
You know, there's always this balance between trying to change the world and then, you know, trying to make sure that you're, you don't neglect your family, you know. And, you know, I think that you have to balance that. I don't think, you know, you should be 100%, you know, saying, okay, I'm going to do nothing else but my family. Because I think we need to change the world. I think it's important for kind of members of the church to seek after, you know, high profile jobs and high profile assignments. And because I think it brings, you know, not only notoriety to the church, but it the people that are under you, you know, love to be led by, you know, gospel principles. So, you know, I think there are times I've sacrificed my family but I think my kids, you know, understand that and they appreciate the fact that, you know, that there has been a lot of people's lives changed because of what I've done. And, you know, my kids have all gone on to do great things but we're very close. And so I think they recognize it. I mean, it was a sacrifice. I mean, we were living in Holiday, Utah. I had pretty much all the money I ever needed to live on the rest of my life. And all of a sudden I come home one day and say, hey kids, we're moving to New York. You know, 9 kids, the youngest was 2 months old, and, you know, to be able to pick that whole family up and move them to a strange land and a strange place was on its surface a sacrifice. But I think the experiences we've had as a family were, you know, have really defined our family in so many ways. Yeah. And I don't think any of them would change that experience for the world. So, you know, sometimes hard things can turn out to be great things, and it worked out for us.
Awesome. It also said in the Mormon Way of Doing Business that you go through a lot of books on CD or audio books. Is that still the case?
I do. Yeah, I do. I can't stand to read a book, but I can nice. Listen to it all day long.
So is there, if you were to say your top 3 books, other than, you know, the obvious, you know, religious books, is there any development, leadership development or personal development books that you would highly recommend?
Well, I'm really partial to Malcolm Gladwell. I love his books, maybe because they're short reads, you know, and I really like Outliers. I think that's a great book. You know, Dave and Goliath, great book, you know, yeah. for a guy with ADD. He talks about, you know, guys like us. And I've actually mentioned in that book. And you know, his first, what was his first book?
Which I loved on,
you know, viral marketing. Tipping Point, yeah. Tipping Point was my first one. And I love that. And so, I'm not really into leadership books. I don't know why. I just feel like it's something that's more innate for me. And I do like world, you know, I read a book recently called The Accidental Superpower, which talks about, you know, kind of world, how the world's going to be over the next 50 to 100 years. And as far as, you know, which countries are going to fade and which ones are going to get stronger, and, you know, kind of preparing, you know, my businesses and myself and my family for, the upcoming changes. And the good news there for the United States in those books, there's the accidental superpower and then the absent superpower. So I like that stuff. And I love history, listening to a book last night, actually, Founding Brothers, about the founders of the... And I've read a lot of books about Washington and Adams and Alexander Hamilton, of course. So, I love history. Love church history and love all kinds of history. So I'm not...
That's awesome.
Obviously, the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People is kind of a mainstay and, practice those principles. But I think Steve Covey took those from, gospel principles. So I think we were all did a little plagiarizing when it comes to, using our life experiences to, in a good way, to influence other people, which I think was a great, great work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to ask you about, and I don't know, do you speak publicly about your involvement with the More Good Foundation or?
I do. I mean, I think More Good was, something that I kind of came up with. I actually, founded it. Actually, I funded it for the first, many years. And, it was just, I just didn't like the way the church was being, we had this thing about, we came out and we abandoned the word Mormon church because we said we aren't the Mormon church. So, and then kind of everyone else took the name, and which was unfortunate because, every time you Googled, you wanted to hear about the church, someone, your neighbor or somebody was interested, you just go in and go Google Mormon church. And then it was just like horrific the stuff you would see. And so, I thought it was time to take over, to take the word back and take the phrase back. And to change, all the the church just wasn't doing a very good job of defending itself because it just wasn't in that mode of defending itself. And then we had all these really talented members that had money and had, obviously the being in Silicon Slopes and all that, that we needed to kind of organize ourselves and kind of defend the church online. So we were kind of kicking around a name. It was kind of funny because I wanted to call it the Porter Rockwell Foundation and just to go out there. I wanted to be the avenging angel, but I was persuaded that Joseph taught that Mormon meant more good. So I thought, okay, well, we'll do more good. We won't be the avengers. But we've had great people running it. And today, Jonathan Johnson does a great job. So
I've had an opportunity.
I think he's done a lot of good.
Yeah, I've had an opportunity to meet with Jonathan and David down there that I just was actually down there last week and to see what they're working on. And they've been a great partner in what we're trying to accomplish at Leading LDS and that you see the things they produce. And it's encouraging as far as the good stuff they put out there. Is there, if people don't know, I mean, how would people recognize it online? I'm sure they recognize it more than they realize, but any of the names or brands come to mind?
Well, it's funny because at first, I started buying up all the URLs, that MormonChurch.org, MormonChurch.com, MormonChurch.net, Jesus.com. I mean, we just bought everything we possibly could. Tried to buy JesusChrist.com, but, they figured out that we were Mormon. So we just were buying up, all the URLs so we could actually, get higher up on the search engines. And then, one of the directors we had, we were worried that, President Hinckley at the time was 97 and we were worried that he was going to pass away. And, all of a sudden people would be Googling Thomas S. Monson. So we wanted to put up a bunch of really good sites on Thomas S. Monson so that everybody would see him as opposed to the negative stuff that was out there. And then the director at the time kind of made the mistake, I think, of calling the First Presidency and asking for permission. I said, well, time out. We don't do that. We're putting up good stuff.
Yeah.
Just count out the bad stuff. And then they kind of wanted to have us give them all our URLs we had. And we said, no, we don't want them in the safe, with everything else. So, and then that was in the beginning and we obviously have had a great relationship with the church, ever since when they saw what we were trying to do. But, at first it was a little bit kind of like, what are you guys doing? But I think, a lot of moving up the search engines, good quality content and, even on YouTube or anywhere else, as opposed to, this. So people have a balanced view of what's going on, as opposed to just a one-sided view.
Yeah, and the one thing that I've learned from the More Good Foundation is, the church wants to put out obviously good content and that puts a good message out about the church. But the More Good Foundation could put up a video, and it's going to cost way less because you don't have to necessarily go through the correlation department. You can you know, you can act much quicker, you're much more lean and still get the resource out there, where the church just doesn't have that. And there's not anything wrong with the church. It's just the way it is, right?
Well, the church has made leaps and bounds. I mean, since we founded Morgan, it's, you know, 1,000 times better than what it was, but they're still not as nimble. And, you know, they had this, we had one guy go up and take a lot of the church videos and put them on YouTube, you know, and then they were like, well, what's going on here? And it's like, well, if you don't put them on, someone's got to put them on, you know,
right?
Someone's got to see the good message. And there was this intellectual reserve that kind of was protecting all this stuff. And it's like, well, so like I said, Jonathan has a great relationship with brethren, and we're working hand in hand, and, you know, they recognize the value, which I think is great. And so it's accomplished everything that I'd hoped that it would accomplish. And, you know, it's, it was an investment well spent.
Yeah, for sure. And I encourage people to check out mormonhub.com. That's sort of your flagship with all things that you produce there. And then there's many, I mean, internationally, it's incredible the work you're doing in different languages and how much more viral things go, you know, in South America as opposed to North America. And anyway, so it's definitely, you're creating some more good. So that's awesome.
Yeah, that was the goal.
Awesome. Well, David, this has been fantastic. I appreciate you. Obviously, you're extremely busy and running to one thing to the next, and you've been so kind to take a few minutes out and talk about your experience and leadership. And I know many leaders out there listening will be inspired and ponder over some of these things you've said. And just as a final question that I generally ask in relation to your leadership experiences, as you've you know, had many opportunities to lead companies and obviously lead in your personal life and your family and your church, how has your time as a leader made you a better follower of Jesus Christ?
Well, I gave a lesson on this last Sunday. You know, I just talked about, you know, your personal relationship with Christ is just really, you know, there's so much noise out there today about historical facts of the church and, you know, so many things that people get caught up in. And, you know, I just think it's important to have a, you know, a personal relationship with Christ and to have a testimony of the Book of Mormon. I think that's really all you need. If those of you have those two things, everything else kind of takes care of itself. But, you know, I think, I feel like I'm, you know, leading by his example is, you know, not 100% all the time, but I think it, you know, I feel like I'm doing what he would want me to do in creating great companies and having people that, you know, just feel happier and more fulfilled. And so it's, without that example in my life, I don't think I'd be the leader I would be today. So I'm grateful for that.
That concludes my interview with David Neeleman. A big shout out to him for being so willing to take time out of his, I can't imagine how busy his schedule is, but nonetheless, chatted with me, and I benefited from it. I'm sure you did as well. You know, I'm really enjoying these interviews, as I always have, but I'm really striving to push the envelope with leading LDS. You know, we've had incredible influencers and leaders, a lot of them business leaders like Gail Miller, now David Neeleman. There is nobody too big for this podcast, all right? And really, the funny thing is, it's those without celebrity, you know, the day-to-day, everyday leaders that really become some of the most popular interviews on Leading LDS. But nonetheless, I would love to reach out to more and more leaders who have really created an influence, whether a public one or a private one, that are making dramatic impact and influence in whatever realm that they're leading, whether it's in the church or in business or in the community. So if you know of anybody that I should reach out or that you could connect me with, shout out to Mitt Romney, please let me know. Send me an email by going to leadinglds.org/contact and let me know what we can arrange. And don't forget, visit leadinglds.org/teach to check out the 3 most viewed sessions from the recent Teaching Saints Virtual Summit. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.